This is Mark Gerson, and I'm the rabbi's husband. Hello, thank you for tuning in. I'm Mark Gerson, and I'm the rabbi's husband. And here, as ever, to unearth the inspiring, instructive, and highly practical wisdom of a Torah passage with a fellow seeker of biblical truth. I am delighted today to be joined by Pastor Gerald Murphy. Pastor Murphy lives in Columbus, Ohio, with his wife, Lauren, and their four children. He is the pastor of the Columbus Dream Center and is the director of community engagement at Catalyst for Columbus. The Dream Center provides medical care, meals, kids outreach, discipleship, and holiday help for the Columbus community. Gerald, welcome to the Rabbi's Husband.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I'm excited about your passage. So you have chosen a passage from the great Parsha of Lech Lecha. And this is passage for those of you with your Bibles in front of you. This is Genesis 15:1. So Gerald, please tell us what happens in Genesis 15:1 and why it's so significant for you.
Yeah, so Genesis 15:1, we see what is the second initiated dialogue or conversation between Yahweh and Abraham. And what's so significant about this particular passage is that in this second conversation, God, he actually defines himself. He names himself. When you go back to the first exchange between God and Abraham, you see the promise is spoken, but God does not identify himself. And here in Genesis 15:1, we get that first picture of how God or how Yahweh wanted to be understood by humanity in this exchange between he and Abraham.
Fascinating. So how does God want to be understood by humanity? What can we learn from the passage?
So what we see is that he speaks to Abraham and he tells him to not be afraid. And then he says that he is his shield. He is Abraham's shield or his defense, and that he is his exceedingly great reward. And those are the first two characteristics that we see Abraham come into the understanding of as it relates to who God is, his character, his nature, that God wanted him to be known as Abraham's shield, his defense, and as his exceedingly great reward. And I believe it's profound to consider out of all of the characteristics, out of all of the attributes of God, those were the two that he chose to bring Abraham into the understanding of first.
Fascinating. And the first thing he says to Abraham in this, as you point out, the second time that God spoke to Abraham, the first thing he says is, fear not.
Yes, absolutely.
In his instruction to Abraham. And the prohibition against fear is the most frequently uttered thing in the Torah. I believe it's 80 times we're told in a whole variety of contexts not to fear. And what you just point out is this is really the first thing that God tells Abraham in the first full conversation. Because I believe the previous time was just God speaking to Abraham, but Abraham not saying anything to God.
Correct.
So this is the first conversation that they have. And the first thing that God says in the first conversation is, do not fear.
Yeah, and to your point, this is something that we see repeated over and over and over again. And when you look at the command and even the invitation to not be afraid, I believe it's significant in that it correlates with who God is. In other words, the reason that Abraham can even respond to this invitation to not be afraid is because God will be his shield and because God will be his defense. And there's something profound about that, that in the invitation to not be afraid, he is ultimately being asked to step into that based upon the nature and character of God himself.
Right. And the immediate preceding event to this, at least as far as we can tell, in other words, the thing that's immediate preceding in the Torah, lots of things may have happened that weren't recorded in the Torah, but the immediate preceding event in the Torah is Abraham's spectacular military victory in the battle of the four kings against the five kings. And then we immediately come to this, and which is the first conversation, and God is telling Abram, after that spectacular victory, do not be afraid, which I think might speak to Abraham's character in the sense that even though he won a spectacular military victory, he still feels fear. He doesn't feel himself invincible just because he won a big fight.
That's a great, great thing to point out, and just the ability to see how God responds to that fear. It's not something that he, you know, told him that he should be ashamed of. It's not something that he prizes him for, but he encourages him and he again reveals his character. And I really look at this passage in the context of Genesis 15, knowing that what happens after this is this covenant that was spoken, the promise that was spoken in Genesis 12, we see now in this chapter actually get carried out through the covenantal ceremony. And it's incredible when you look at that scene later on in this chapter and what God would invite Abraham into after having introduced himself, after having told him not to be afraid, after having said that he would be his shield and his reward. I think it's very significant when you look at the covenant that would be carried out just a few passages later.
So after God tells Abraham in the passage that you chose, "Fear not, Abraham, I will be a shield for you. Your reward is very great." Abraham speaks to God, making this the first conversation in the Bible, a conversation defined as two people speaking with each other. And Abraham says to God, this is 15:2, "My Lord Hashem, what can you give me, seeing that I go childless and the steward of my house is Eliezer?" So God says your reward's going to be great, but this teaches us about faith. God says your reward's going to be great. One would think that a man of faith would just say, "Oh, thank you." But Abraham, in the first conversation, challenges God. The first thing we see a man doing with God is challenging him. Abraham says, "God, what can you," imagine the audacity, saying to God, "what can you give me?" That's what he says. He says, "what can you give me, given that effectively my wife and I are barren and all we want is a child? So you can't give me anything, God. All I want is a child and you're not giving it to me." This Abraham challenging God. And then does God like being challenged or not? Then we see immediately thereafter how God responds. He says, "you're right. I'm going to give you a son with Sarah."
It's so real. And it brings us into what I believe is God's desire in those exchanges to actually embrace, you know, the very human response. How can this be? How can you give me anything great when I don't even have a son? And knowing in that culture, ancient Mesopotamian culture, that would have been considered the greatest reward is the offspring and is the continuation of your legacy through a male child. And so you see Abram's humanity and what was ultimately his greatest desire in his response to God. And to your point, the conversation continued. God didn't strike him down for questioning him. God didn't strike him down for challenging him.
No, God seems to want the challenge. This is what he seems to want the people he created, the people he really loves to do, is to challenge him. And you're absolutely right. I mean, in ancient Mesopotamian culture, in ancient times, the tragedy of childlessness is almost incomprehensible. I mean, we see it over and over again in the Bible. We see it with Abraham and Sarah. We see it with Hannah. Noah, who comes before Abraham, of course, has his first child at age 500, leading us to believe that he and his wife, who is not named, interestingly, were presumably childless too. But and there are many other examples too. It's an existential struggle. And so Abraham, as you said, being fully human, God says, "your reward's very great," and fully human, he says, "I only want one thing. Like, there's only one thing I want, and that's a child." And Abraham probably respects science because he's saying, "you can't give it to me," because effectively he knows that Sarah's too old. She's 90, right? So he's saying, "the only thing I want is a child. She's too old. What are we talking about here?" And God loves it.
Right. It's profound because from what we can read, there's nothing that would have informed Abraham that there was even space to talk back to God. There's nothing that we read that tell us that he had seen or he had been exposed to what one human being is even allowed to say back to God, the creator. And so it's fascinating to see this. And it's also fascinating to recognize that God, the creator of the universe, chooses to introduce himself to one man on the other side of the flood, but then come to know is the catalyst to his redemptive work and ultimately the birth of Israel as a nation. He chose one man to begin that process with. So there's so many things about this from both the human side, but also from God's perspective that are just really astounding.
Yes, he chooses one man, he chooses Abram. He may have previously thought that he was going to choose Noah, but then Noah completely fails in the task because when God says to him effectively, "it's time to recreate the world, get out of the ark," well, the ark stops. Noah has to wait to be told to get out of the ark. He's not even in any rush to get out of the ark and recreate the world. God tells him, he does it. And then he gets drunk. I mean, he wasn't going to recreate the world. He was the wrong man for the job. Abraham is who God said, "there's my man." And then we have to say, well, what is so great about Abraham? What qualities does Abraham have that make him God's chosen partner? And I think the first thing we can come up with is that Abraham argues with God.
Absolutely. And it's in that argument that, going down just a little bit in verse 6, you see that God's response is that it was faith. Because the scripture says in verse 6 that he believed in the Lord and he accounted it, he being God, accounted it to him for righteousness, which is also fascinating because it demonstrates that belief is not the absence of challenging. Belief and faith is not the absence of actually exposing our humanity and actually telling God, this is actually hard to comprehend. How are you going to do this? But what I see is the faith and the belief was that Abraham responded, made his doubts known, was vulnerable, submitted them to God, and then received his response. And at that moment, God says, that's belief, that's faith, and I'm going to account it to you as righteousness.
That faith exists in the doubts and faith exists in the challenge.
Yes.
Right. You know, if this was a children's book, what would it be? The children's book would have God saying, how dare you to question me? I'm the Lord. You just follow me. And Abraham complied. That's a children's book. But this is not a children's book. This is the real thing. And so what we learn is that how many people go through life with doubts? Everybody. And what is God saying? Everybody, every day. And what's God saying? You know, I love you with your doubts.
Yes. Bring me the challenge. Bring me the doubt. And I think that's the significance, is not imagining a world where we don't doubt, not imagining a world where we don't have moments of unbelief, but choosing that we're going to bring that doubt to the Lord, choosing that we're going to bring, you know, that unbelief to God and engage in that dialogue that, again, he initiates to begin with. And he knew that doubt would be there. He knew that unbelief, that inability to comprehend would be there, but God chose to initiate that conversation with humanity, knowing that that would be there, and invites us to actually engage with him in the midst of it.
Right. And then God responds and says, that one, your steward, Eliezer, he's not the one that's going to hurt you. He said, you're going to have a son. God says, gaze now towards the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. And he says, so shall your offspring be. This is God talking to a 100-year-old child, this Abraham. He said, count the stars, and that's where your offspring will be. Now, I think stars is such an interesting analogy because God could have, I mean, Abraham presumably was in southern Israel in the desert. God could have said, look at the sand and count the sand. There are lots of analogies that were accessible to God, but he picks stars. And in the biblical imagination, it comes through so clearly in Isaiah, among other places, that stars, even in ancient times, everybody knew that each star was unique. I mean, this is in Proverbs, that each star is unique. So God is saying it's not just numerical. He said, each star is unique. Consequently, each person is unique. And it's also an analogy that God is giving Abraham as the first Jew, in that in ancient times, the only way that you could steer your way at night was by looking at the stars through stellar navigation. And he's saying, you know, your descendants will be like the stars, you know, make people want to be like them. That's my goal for you. That's my moral ambition for you, is to be like the stars, make people want to be like you, to follow you. I want to go where I'm going by the stars. And that's God's charge to Abraham and through Abraham to all of us.
Absolutely. And when you pick up right after that, really the rest of the chapter, you see that covenantal ceremony that I referred to. And I want to touch on this a little bit and looking at verses 9 through 21, because I think this is where we actually begin to see exactly what God meant when he said, I would be your exceedingly great reward. And that word, it's pay, it's wages, it's the hired price or the benefit. And I know when I first unpack that, it didn't quite make sense until I understood that that was being said in light of this covenantal ceremony that was just about to take place. And when I look at this, I see God saying, Abraham, I'm going to be the reward. I'm going to be the hired price, the wage that you receive based upon entering into this covenant relationship with me. This is what you will see as your wage for coming in to this covenant relationship, which is profound because, as we mentioned already, it'd be easy to look at the offspring to eventually see, you know, Isaac, who would be born later, the true wage or price. But God is saying, no, your offspring, Isaac, and the descendants, the nation that's going to be birthed from you, don't see that as your reward, but see me, see this relationship, see this covenant relationship with me as the true reward for stepping in to this. And it's so significant, even when you look at the scene there in Genesis 15, 9 through 21, when you really get to the covenantal ceremony and they walk through that process of taking the animals and cutting them in half. And that middle passage, you can imagine the blood that's flowing from the animals. And typically, as you know, you would have two kings walk through that middle passageway, signifying that they were both saying yes to this covenant, and that if either of them broke it, they would end up like these animals, cut in half and ultimately separated, and the covenant would be broken. But what we see is that Abraham is sleeping, and only the oven, the smoking oven, and only the burning torch, the manifest presence of God, it's the only thing that passes through the separated animals. And so the guarantee of the covenant relationship was really God making a promise to himself that Abraham, who was sleeping, would be the beneficiary of, which is so significant when we see the rest of the story with Israel and how often they broke the covenant. But going back to this little scene, well, Abraham didn't even pass through the middle passageway. He was asleep.
That's right. He was asleep. And you're so right. It says it's, and it's so important to emphasize that your reward, God is saying, I'll be your reward, I'll be your shield, and I'll be your reward. And as your shield and your reward, you are not to fear. And, you know, I think if you look through history at like who really understood this in the biblical meaning of the word understand, which means act upon it and make it a part of you, it was Martin Luther King. I mean, if you look at Martin Luther King's last speech, I mean, it seems to be saying exactly what Abraham would have wanted people to say in 1951. He said, well, this is Martin Luther King, and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. When you're in that kind of communion with God, when you truly have faith in God, you're not fearing any man.
Absolutely. And even the fear of not seeing the fullness of the promise and not seeing what it is that you've been hoping towards. And when God becomes your reward, you can have contentment. Your faith is in that God will complete and he will establish and he will ultimately come through with what he promised. But your reward is God. Your reward is fellowship with God, knowing God, being in a relationship with God. You're not primarily motivated even by the manifestation of the promise, but you trust God to do that. You've already found your reward in being in that covenant relationship with God. And I think that's very, very significant to what we're seeing between God and Abraham. And even when you point to Martin Luther King, knowing that that peace that he had, that the hope was there, even if he wasn't going to be present to see the fulfillment of it.
That's a great point. And I think what we're seeing in Martin Luther King is just what a person can do when they really internalize 15:1. I mean, you're so right. So why is Martin Luther King able to be content while seemingly prophesizing his death? Because before that, the quote that we just read, he says, like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity have its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. So he's saying, I'd like to live a long life, but he's saying, I'm not concerned about it. In other words, it's probably not going to happen. He seemed to know, but you're right. He had this contentment because God was his reward. Because he has faith, God is his reward. Because it's God's reward, he's not fearing.
And it reminds me of, you know, just what we see even with Moses. When you get to the Exodus, and now the children of Israel are in position to actually step into the promised land, there's a profound statement in Exodus 33:15 that's very akin to what we're seeing here. And that because of Israel being in that time, a people that God already knew were going to be disobedient, God tells Moses, listen, I'll send angels ahead of you to conquer your enemies and to ensure that you receive the promised land. I'm just not going to go with you. And then we see in Exodus 3:15, Moses says, listen, if you don't come with us, if your presence doesn't come with us, don't take us up from this mountain. And I really see the similarity that Moses understood, like Abraham, no, God himself, God's presence is the actual reward. So much so that he was saying, God, if we don't have your presence, I don't want the promise. If we don't have you, if you're not with us in this, then don't even give us the land. And I think that's what we can really learn from as those who are following and seeking God, is that he himself is our reward. No matter what it is that we are called to, the assignment on our life, the promises, the things that we're hoping for, if God's not going to be with us, it's never going to satisfy.
Right. So God himself is the reward. In other words, nothing external is the reward. God's the reward. And yeah, fascinating. And in the Moses story that you spoke of, I think Moses really speaks deeply to the idea of a partnership. He says, if God's not with us, there's no point in going. But then when God says to Moses, effectively, I'm sick of these people. I'm going to start again. This is after the golden calf. I'm sick of these people. I'm going to start again with you. Moses, if you're going to do that, blot me out of your Torah. And Moses is probably the one person without whom, if you took him out of the Torah, it makes no sense. You know, well, maybe Abraham, but certainly Moses, he makes absolute, you cannot have the Torah without Moses. So Moses knows that he's kind of got God, right? He follows the Abrahamic tradition of arguing with God. He knows he's got him. He says, there's no Torah without me, so just take me out. But what you're saying is it's really both. He's saying, God, if you're not with us, there's no point in going. And if we're not with you, take me out of your Torah and you got nothing.
And there's this pattern. And I love the Psalms because there's these kind of consistent reminders of, you know, the beauty of God's presence and his person being in relationship with God over and over and over again. We see David and the other writers of the Psalms bring us back to this understanding. I think about Psalm 16:11, where it talks about in his presence, the presence of God is the fullness of joy, at his right hand, pleasures forevermore. I think about Psalm 27:4, where David says, this one thing I've desired and that I will seek, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. In that same chapter, this expectation to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. It goes on and on. One of my favorites is Psalm 63:3, because your loving kindness, speaking of God, is better than life itself. Because of that, my lips will praise you. That one always gets me because it's like, you know, God is God. So he could absolutely demand praise and worship, and he does. But there's this sense that he prefers praise and worship in a life that's lived for him, that is response to actually knowing that his loving kindness is better than anything else that life has to offer. And when that's really understood, the default response will be to praise him with our whole lives. And so this idea of God being the reward, I think is so pervasive in the scriptures and, you know, the word. And it's something that grounds us, and it's something that can really become an anchor for how we approach life.
And if you look at God as your reward, as Martin Luther King demonstrated, you won't fear anything. You'll do the right thing. You won't fear anything. And you'll realize that the true mark of a great person, or really a good person, is that they will die with their work unfinished because their work is bigger than them. That happened to Moses. Moses doesn't get to the promised land. That's what Moses taught us.
That's really good. No, I think those two things are so interconnected. Seeing God rightly as the reward absolutely will bring about a fearlessness, because doing his will, pleasing him, glorifying him, seeing his desires come to pass, and knowing the sacrifice and knowing the hardship one will always go through when they're truly living in a way that is selfless and is motivated by seeing what God desires come to pass, especially when it's on behalf of others, that's going to always bring about, you know, a demand for being courageous. And when God's our reward, that courage, that fearlessness will absolutely be there.
Gerald, thank you for such a fascinating discussion about Genesis 15:1. And I had never really thought about God as a reward before you taught it just now. So such an important part of the Parsha and really the Bible. And I never really focused on it or thought about it before you brought it up. So thank you. It's such an important and sustaining part of the Bible into where the Bible lives today, which is in our lives all day, every day. Now, the concluding question always goes from one text, which is the sacred text of the Bible, to another text, which is Andre Malraux's 1968 book, Anti-Memoir. He said, I just ran into a man with whom I served in the war. And he said, this man had saved a lot of Jews and then had become a parish priest. So I said to the priest, in all of your years of hearing confessions, what are two things you've learned about mankind? And the priest said, one, everyone is much less happy than he seems. And two, there is no such thing as a grown-up person. So in your years of pastoring so many people in Columbus, Ohio, what are two things that you've learned about mankind?
Two things I would say I've learned about mankind is that there is a unceasing desire that we have to earn what has been freely given to us in our relationship with God. There's this addiction, if you will, that we have to self-righteousness that has to continuously be addressed. And the second thing that I would say that I've learned about humankind is that responding to God in worship is a lot more natural than I believe most would consider it to be. And when people are given that opportunity to come back into their created order, which is knowing God and walking in relationship with him, it's way more natural than a lot of people are led to believe.
Natural in what sense? Like, what do people expect, and then what do they experience?
I think people expect for relationship with God to be something that is both a complicated and fearful pursuit. I think people expect for a God that, in this example, is willing and ready to, you know, chastise them and really be harsh toward them when they respond with doubt and with unbelief. And they expect to see a God that is really looking to, you know, punish them for that doubt and for that unbelief, and not a God that we see in Genesis 15 who welcomes that and is in that looking to affirm and in that looking to actually help us see that there's more faith on the inside of us than we realize.
Very interesting. Now, getting back to your first point, I think you're very profound and totally right when you say that people want to earn. I mean, interestingly, when God in Exodus, when God gives us manna, it's the perfect food. You think we'd be thrilled with it. Instead, we get deeply upset and we start grinding it and milling it. We start working on it. Why do we want to work on the perfect food? It's a completed product. We can't improve it. It's perfect. The answer is because that's what we do and that's who we are. We're people who work, we're people who want to improve just because we want to do it. We want to earn what we have, and we're dissatisfied with the manna because it was freely given. And that's not the natural state of a person. We don't want things to be freely given. So it's a great insight you have, but how do you tie it into self-righteousness?
For me, it's the idea that in all of these relationships that we see, you know, going up back to Genesis 3:9, it's God who initiates coming to make himself known. He is the transcendent yet immanent, and he is the knowable and self-revealing God, meaning that he's outside of what we in our finite minds can comprehend fully, but yet he makes himself known within the limits of our understanding. And he's the one who initiates the revealing of himself, and then he actually provides what's necessary to respond to what he reveals. So he's actually knowable. And I believe that it's human nature to resist what is, again, that dynamic where God is the one who's initiating the relationship. We are still in the mindset of oftentimes where it's us trying to get to him when we see from the beginning that it's always been him initiating relationship with us. And so from Adam to Noah to Abraham to Isaac later on in Genesis 26 to Moses, as we mentioned in Exodus 3, each of these episodes, we see it being God initiating relationship with man. These individuals weren't necessarily looking for God. They weren't necessarily trying to, you know God. God made himself known. And I think we would prefer it to be the other way around. If we do the right thing, or if we, if you will, can figure out on our own, we can get to God, where we see again in all of these examples, it's God who initiates relationship with us.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for such a fascinating discussion about the awesome passage of Genesis 15:1 and the existential questions that follow.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You are the God of the breakthrough. If you believe there's a breakthrough in the house tonight, clap your hands up high. We shall breakthrough. You are the God. You are the God of the breakthrough. Oh, and when I can't see my way through, and I really don't know what to do, I look to you. If you're enjoying this episode, I hope that you'll sign up for the Rabbi's Husband newsletter, which includes book giveaways from our podcast guests, my weekly column on Christian Broadcasting Network, inspiring updates from United Hatzalah and African Mission Healthcare, and a behind-the-scenes look at my upcoming book published by St. Martin's Essentials, The Telling, How Judaism's Essential Book Reveals the Meaning of Life. You can sign up at therabbishusband.com or feel free to email Daniel at therabbishusband.com.